from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT. Today I'm going to cover some key issues directly focused on war, obviously talk about conflict, and I should mention that this is going to be a little shorter version of STRAT. Instead of doing one longer, say, what's become normally about 30 minutes plus of STRAT, I'm going to be doing a couple of 15-minute STRATs per week. So I'm going to do one now, and then in the middle of the week, I'll be doing another STRAT. And this is going to focus on just one topic. And, of course, the topic this week is going to be the ever-controversial, and I guess it would have to be controversial, the U.S. military strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities that happened on June 22nd. And even though that was a while back, the simple reality is that that those strikes continue to cause all kinds of issues because of the very nature of what they are and because the U.S. did actually conduct a military strike on Iran. And so I'm going to talk about that. And a matter of expression, the fallout continues, pun intended, on these strikes against nuclear targets. But let me go into what happened. There were 7 B-2 bombers that were used. This is a unique bomber. The U.S. has this bomber. It's a stealth bomber. We've had it for a number of years, but we're the only country in the world that has a bomber like this. And we developed this GBU. This is what's called a massive ordnance penetrator bomb that can actually go in and do this deep strike underground. It penetrates the ground, hence the term penetrator, penetrates the ground deeply down to about 200 feet and then explodes. And when it explodes, all that kinetic energy goes into the earth and hopefully collapses underground bunkers, cavities, facilities that are in there. And that's exactly what was at the Fordo site. There was 3 different sites, but the Fordo site was the one where they really needed this massive ordnance penetrator bomb. And we're the only country in the world that has it. And the only delivery system for it is a B-2 bomber. And the only option that other option out there was for Israel to do an extremely high-risk mission, putting in commandos or some sort of commando-type mission at the Fordo facility. And so that it was really kind of down to what can be done to eliminate this risk of Iran using that facility to enrich uranium to create what was thought to be potentially up to 9 nuclear bombs that they might have been able to put together by the end of the month. Might have. There's a lot of conjecture on that right now, but that's what that was part of the strategic thinking process on that, which is if we don't do it now, we may end up having a nuclear weapon armed Iran within a couple of weeks. So beyond the damage that was done at those 3 sites, and I should mention, Fordo was primarily the B-2 bombers, and then there was dozens of Tomahawk missiles. These are cruise missiles, very large warheads, that were launched from a submarine in the Indian Ocean. And the combined damage to 3 nuclear sites was truly devastating, all right? Beyond the kinetic damage is the message. And the message is this, that the U.S. has some very unique capabilities, militarily speaking, that we can apply. And it was something that I think is kind of misunderstood. It's not just that the U.S. did these strikes. It's what the U.S. did these strikes with. And it sends a message that certainly was heard in Iran, but something that was clearly observed in Moscow, Beijing, and other world capitals, that yes, the U.S. has these weapons, and yes, the U.S. is willing to employ these weapons when they see that they need to do so. And I think that was a big strategic message that was put out there. Now, as far as the missions themselves, tremendous precision. The intelligence that was talked about or discussed by General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, when he talked about how they did it, using one MOP to basically blow off the hatch of the ventilation system, and then the other MOPs literally going down the ventilation shafts and doing this massive strike. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm not the only one. There was visions of Luke Skywalker and Star Wars when they were talking about how this thing actually rolled out. But everything that I've seen was tremendous precision, flawless execution, and nothing but praise going to the military planners, the aviators, everybody involved in these missions, either on the B-2 bomber side in the MOPs or on the Tomahawk missile side. It just was I say this very tentatively, but it was essentially a flawless execution of a very difficult military mission. All right. Now, that's what happened. Enormous damage to facilities, enormous damage to Iran's nuclear program. Now, what's caused a lot of controversy is that President Trump came out and basically used the expression that these targets have been obliterated. Obliterated is not a term that's used in military science or art. That is just not one of the ways we describe what happens to a target. Suppressed, destroyed, partially destroyed, damaged, these are all terms that we would normally use. Obliterated is not a term that would normally be used. And of course, just using the term obliterated caused a lot of focus and attention on that use of that term. And then there was pushback that maybe this is a bit of an overstatement, that we don't have the battle damage assessment, that the president was jumping the gun, saying that something had been basically obliterated or destroyed, when in fact we didn't know what the extent of the damage to the targets was at that point. And of course, that caused a lot of issues. Iran's response was that they targeted Al Udeid Air Base, our military air base in Qatar, right near Doha, and they fired 14 missiles. Ironically, or I should say coincidentally, the B-2 bombers carry two of these GBU-50 bombs, these MOP bombs. So 2 times 7 is 14, and that's exactly the number, and I guess they must have just ignored all the Tomahawk missiles. But that's exactly the number of missiles that Iran shot into Al Udeid, into Qatar. What's also interesting is that they actually called the Qatar, they notified Qatar and said, by the way, we're going to be firing missiles at Al Udeid Air Base. And I was like, well, okay, so they got warning. And apparently there was some communication with the White House saying this. And President Trump said something about he may have given permission for them to, it was very unclear. That he gave permission for them to fire missiles at our air base targeting a U.S. military facility. I'm just not quite sure what that meant. That just sounds very strange. I've never heard of any president ever giving permission for an enemy force to fire on one of our military bases. That was just very odd. And maybe it was just a turn of phrase that didn't quite come across correctly, but it would just seem very strange. Long story short, the base had been evacuated for the most part. The planes were pretty much gone. And the air defense system, if you will, the Patriot missile system, was completely successful in stopping those missiles from causing any damage on the base. That nothing happened to the base, but it was rather odd, this whole thing where it was almost a very orchestrated attack by the Iranians that they felt they had to respond. And they did this thing, but they did so in such a way they didn't use their higher performance ballistic missiles. They used missiles that were actually much easier to take out with the Patriot system. And they gave all this fair warning that they're going to do so. And then, of course, once they fired them, they grossly exaggerated the effect of those missiles, claiming that they had done things that they had not done, which is kind of par for the course with the way the Iranians describe anything. So what is the status of Iran's nuclear program now? Well, the thing that caused great controversy was there was a leaked report, reportedly, according to everything it was said, it was a DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency report, preliminary report of the battle damage assessment that basically said that the targets had not been obliterated in so many terms, that their nuclear program had not been set back that much. It was only a few months away from reconstituting. And of course, that became a very politically charged discussion point. However, one of the things I would point out that if someone in DIA released a highly classified report talking about the battle damage assessment from this thing, which would have been probably top secret, would be my guess, potentially top secret, probably compartmented, code word protected, if you will, depending on the sources and methods used to come up with this, that is very wrong to release that publicly. All right. All politics aside, all partisan politics aside, there are certain things that go with the good order and discipline of the military services and also the rules of the road within the intelligence community that things like that just aren't done. And it's not just because it was the report or the assessment was half-baked or undone or whatever it was. It's the fact that it's highly classified. You just don't put that stuff, throw that out there. Obviously, it was very political. The White House took this as and basically said as much that they saw this as a comment disparaging the courage or professionalism of the air crews and those involved with the mission. I don't know if I quite saw the connection there. That was kind of how it got spun by the White House. Obviously, there was certainly an amount of discouragement within the operating forces that something like this would get out there when the full assessment had been not done. Now, other assessments have come out subsequent to this, saying that there was extreme damage and that the program was probably put back a year, maybe a couple of years, in terms of Iran's ability to reconstitute it. I've heard estimates that say even further than a couple of years, but obviously there was a lot of damage done to the facilities themselves. Now, there are some questions that are coming out, which is, did Iran actually retain some enriched uranium in other locations? Do they actually have some centrifuges somewhere else? Or maybe centrifuges on the site that weren't completely destroyed that they could use to enrich uranium. That, I don't know. That's always possible. There's reports that there were trucks seen at that location prior to the strikes and, you know, speculation that maybe some of the uranium was moved. Again, that's very possible. Doesn't take away from what happened with those strikes. Doesn't take away from the damage that was inflicted at those facilities from the strikes. But lots of things can happen, and that's certainly a possibility. And I don't think we're going to run bombing missions all over Iran, trying to hit every possible place where there could be nuclear material. That would be a somewhat of an overwhelming task. And Iran is a really big country. So that's one of the reasons you wouldn't do that. What leaking this preliminary assessment does, it does damage national security. And it does indicate potential methods, sources, if you will, of how that information could have been gleaned, potentially endangering our ability to use those sources and methods. And if it's a human source, obviously, it could actually endanger folks on the ground. And right now, Iran is going around all over, the government of Iran, should say, is going all over Iran, scooping up people and just charging them with espionage and reportedly doing quite a few executions in very short order based on that, which certainly appears to be less based on any sort of valid evidence and more just scooping up anybody that they don't like and then running them through some sort of, you know, fake trial or whatever and executing them to make a political statement. So there's a lot of reasons why you want to protect sources and methods for this sort of stuff. There's a lot of focus on Congress as a possible source of leak. There's even the White House even talked about maybe there's a need to restrict the amount of classified material that goes to Congress. There's issues with Congress that a lot of people don't realize. Number one is there is a shortage. Congress is a big organization, a lot of staffers, everything else, and it's very difficult to keep them all in line and make sure that they don't do stuff that will leak to the press. Because I got to tell you, on just about anything in Congress, it's highly politicized. A lot of bipartisan, or not bipartisan, but a lot of partisan debate on everything. And sometimes there's staffers that will think they're doing the right thing by getting stuff out there. They do see stuff that gets leaked to the press on a variety of issues that come before Congress, and some of them will run out there with these national security things to say that, and they can't do that. That's wrong. The other problem with Congress is that they don't actually have adequate number of SCIFs. These are facilities designed for actually looking at reviewing classified materials. That probably needs to be expanded much further in Congress, from what I understand. They don't have enough terminals to some of the classified systems that we have for everybody to get full access or to get greater access to this so they can see this stuff. So there's a lot of issues with Congress dealing with how it's getting classified materials. The idea that the executive branch would tell the legislative branch that they can't know what's going on in such and what was reportedly kind of a blanket manner, that's obviously a very concern, a big concern, but I don't know if that's exactly what was said. They're talking about, you know, maybe being just a little more restrictive with some of the things that they are sharing with the number of people they're sharing with in Congress. However, I should mention that with this strike, there was no violation of the War Powers Act. No, you did not have to have the president go to Congress to get a declaration of war to do something like this. You know, there was nothing like that. And there was a lot of loose, kind of very partisan rhetoric that was taking place. And I would go back and look at a number of things that have taken place under a variety of presidents, you know, both Democrats and Republicans, where they have used military action. And and frankly, they haven't gone to Congress for a declaration of war since World War II. You know, if you're asking for a declaration of war, I think you're kind of shouting in the wilderness right now, because that just has not been the way we do things. Now, is Iran days or weeks or months or years from a nuclear bomb? Well, the situation before was, it sounded like they were weeks away if they decided to build a nuclear weapon. Now they're several months or a year or two away if they try to reconstitute their program. But it's not clear that they really can reconstitute their program in short order. Right now, they have some devastated facilities. I'm sure underground they are with Fordo. It's very irradiated what's going on there. So I'm not quite sure how fast they could do anything. And then the other thing is, if they do try to build an atomic bomb, what will the U.S. or Israel do at that point if we actually see evidence of that? And will we do another strike? That's very possible. It's difficult to know. Now, Ayatollah Khomeini's situation is very difficult right now. He was basically hiding in a bunker, and there was a lot of discussion of where's Khomeini throughout Iran and around the rest of the world. He kind of semi-surfaced to do a little press conference. The typical over-the-top rhetoric that you would expect from the Iranians, very combative, you know, threatening everybody with things that they really probably can't do. But that was sort of what Khomeini does. But his regime is in a difficult situation because prior to the truce, if you will, that's currently in place, Israel had pretty much run of the skies all over Iran. There was nothing the Iranian regime could do to protect the people of Iran from Israeli military strikes. And whereas Israel was hitting military targets and key infrastructure targets that were aimed at causing damage to the regime and leadership targets as well within the regime, so it wasn't like some wholesale bombing across all of Iran. The fact that Israeli military jets were so able to just freely run around Iran without being opposed by anything in terms of air defense or anything like that puts a deep doubt in the minds of Iranians. I mean, one of the core reasons you have a government is, in fact, the most important core reason you have a government is to be able to protect the people. And that's something that the Iranian regime could not do. All right. Now, is this a tipping point? That is unclear. And everybody's looking really hard to see where this is. You got to remember, Ayatollah Khomeini's regime was deeply unpopular. About 80 to 90% of the population opposed the regime. Multiple mass demonstrations had happened over the last, 15 years, or 16, 17 years, opposing the regime over and over again, and they were brutally suppressed by the regime in every single case. But there is still a lack of public support for the regime. So, in fact, it was once said that when things were heating up, that Ayatollah Khomeini had a two-front war. One front was the external front, which was what Israel and the U.S. might do, and the other was the internal front, which was what the Iranian people might do to the regime. So that still could happen. The other thing, too, is there appears to be some movement on the Abraham Accords, which is that is where Arab nations, Middle Eastern nations, have been recognizing Israel and Israel's right to exist, but also normalizing relations with Israel, exchanging embassy or putting in embassies, exchanging diplomatic personnel, all the things that go with normalization of relations. And that looks like it might get charged up pretty darn fast. You might see a number of countries suddenly jump on board. Syria is being discussed as a possible country that might recognize Israel. That's just stunning when you think about the history on that one. Saudi Arabia is making, which is really the big country in the Middle East, that would recognize Israel. And if that happens, that would be a sea change. Of course, the Palestinian issue, the issue of a Palestinian state, is first and foremost in that. One thing has happened out of this is, you know, obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu is coming to the United States. He's going to, have some high-level discussions. And there appears to be some move on Gaza, and we'll see what that turns out to be. So something could happen there. Could the Iranian regime be overthrown by popular, some sort of popular overthrow, or could there be a military coup? Any of these things are within the realm of possibility. And if you remember how events rolled out so quickly in Moscow in 1991, and certainly in Eastern Europe in the, you know, the 2 years before that, one cannot rule out anything. And don't forget what happened in the Middle East with Libya, Egypt, and elsewhere, that things can happen, and they can happen very fast, and it can catch us by surprise. Anyway, much to mull over. Thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for watching this. Please visit stratpodcast.com, and you can go to my YouTube channel, halkempfertv.com, and go to my company's website at gripsa or gripsa.com as well. So anyway, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and we'll have another Strat out in a few days.